So I wanted to start with those words from a poem by Rumi, the Sufi poet. And tonight I thought, I mean, I really like Rumi, but tonight it just felt I've got the perfect excuse in that Lina, who's becoming a Mitra, is from Syria and was born into Islam, and Sufi poetry is Islamic mysticism, sort of Islam at its finest. And I really love these lines of transcendence that Rumi evokes, from earth to plant to animal to human to angelic form, and then from angelic form to plunge into this ocean of consciousness. And what have you ever lost by dying? What a lovely way of putting this transcending momentum, this quest for more. I wanted to start with those lines because I think they evoke something of the spirit of what I want to talk about tonight. What I want to talk about tonight is one of the distinctive emphases of Triratna, as we've been exploring. Perhaps it's the main distinctive emphases of Triratna. One could argue that this is Bhante Sangharakshita's central insight into what practicing the Dharma means, what Buddhism really is, and how he terms it, how it is termed traditionally, is that what really makes us Buddhists, Buddhist, what makes us Buddhist, is our going for refuge to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And this act, as it were, of going for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma and Sangha, is the central act of the spiritual life, the central act of a Buddhist life. It's common in all Buddhist traditions to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But what Bhante Sangharakshita has seen, because I don't think it's just an intellectual seeing, it's an insightful seeing, what he's seen is that that is the central act of a Buddhist. In other Buddhist traditions, the central act isn't defined necessarily in terms of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So, for example, in some Buddhist traditions, the central act would be becoming a monk or a nun. In some Buddhist countries, you can't, if you're a woman, you can't actually be ordained anymore. Female ordination has died out in a lot of Eastern Buddhist countries. So, in a way, you couldn't fully become a Buddhist in those traditions. Or in, I don't know, in the Tibetan tradition, the central act would be some sort of tantric initiation, and then you were ready to practice. Different traditions would have quite different ways of seeing what it is that one does in order to become a Buddhist. In Triratna, what Bhante's emphasized is that the central act of a Buddhist is going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And I want to just unpack what that means as fully as I can in the talk tonight. And what he's saying is that this act of going for refuge, it's not just central in Triratna, it's actually what unites us to the whole Buddhist world. But the distinctiveness of Triratna is that we see this as the centrality of being a Buddhist. It's the centrality of going for refuge that makes it distinctive. But it also gives us something that unites us to the whole of the Buddhist world. Although they may not use those terms, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and taking refuge in the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha is something that we all have in common. So I'm going to step back from those words, going for refuge to the three jewels, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and just look at the spiritual life a bit more principally, as Bhante has recently outlined and Subhuti has recently outlined. And I don't really have a formal talk, so I'm just going to ramble a bit around that, and I'll maybe look up things that Subhuti's said recently. What Subhuti in particular outlines is that the whole of the Buddhist spiritual life, the whole of the spiritual life, is conceived in terms of moving towards enlightenment, moving towards what Buddhists call Bodhi. Bodhi being a synonym for enlightenment, for awakening, for waking up to the way things really are, for realizing our true nature, for becoming a Buddha. A Buddha is a title meaning awake, and Bodhi is that awakening. So the whole of the spiritual life is oriented towards Bodhi, towards awakening, towards enlightenment. And the whole of Buddhism can be conceived as a path from where we are now to full and perfect enlightenment, to the Buddha. That's what Buddhism is. Buddhism is all the teachings of Buddha, of Buddhism, can be seen as method, as methodological, rather than as doctrinal. All the teachings of Buddhism are methods for helping us move along that path. And that path, which is a central metaphor in Buddhism, isn't really an external path. It's not something outside of us. The path is actually us, in us. We are the path. Because it's not that we, me as I am now, walk along some yellow brick road to Buddhahood. What happens is that as we practice, as each of us practices, we change. We change, and that is us walking the path. So we become the path. We are the path. We are that transformation that we're trying to bring about. We grow, we evolve. That's another one of Bhante's central kind of insights, that he sees the spiritual life in terms of growth and evolution, which is so much more attractive, at least to me, than seeing it in terms of negation and cutting off craving, for example, cutting off desire, of renouncing all wanting. For somebody like me, who is, I'm a greed type, which doesn't mean that I don't also have anger and delusion and hatred and things, but I specialise in greed. And the thought of the spiritual life as renouncing all wanting feels singularly unattractive to me. What does feel much more attractive is that I take all this wanting, this yearning, this desire that I feel like I'm full of sometimes, and I try and transform it, I try and sublimate it, I try and direct it towards the Buddha, towards Bodhi, towards what will give me real fulfillment, real meaning, real value, real freedom in the way that nothing else will. So this sublimation, this transformation of desire is something that I want to come back to. You could see that in terms of growth and evolution. And Rumi in this poem is pointing to that evolutionary metaphor. He's saying earth becomes plant, we grow from earth, we became plant, we became animal, we became human. We can become angelic, and don't stop there, he says. We can transcend all limitation, all ways of defining ourselves. All definition is limitation, so we can transcend form itself. And something mysterious happens. He says that it's not just that rather hackneyed cliche of the drop merging into the ocean, which is beautiful but has become rather cliched. he says, and Bante says this, that it's not just that the drop that we are merges into the infinite of the ocean. Somehow the ocean also becomes the drop. The ocean also becomes the drop. Because we can achieve enlightenment somehow in this form, in this body, this very life. The Buddha did it. The Buddha, in human form, became infinite. In a finite vessel, if you like, the consciousness that was the Buddha was without limitation, without any way of being defined. It was infinite, transcending all notions that even our reason can put onto it. So enlightenment is beyond not just the limitations of form, but as an experience, it's said to be beyond even the limitations of space and time, which are constructs of the unenlightened mind. All limitations are seen as constructs of the unenlightened mind. So this infinite in the finite, this infinite ocean in the drop, feels to me even more attractive than just losing myself in the ocean, if you see what I mean, and being drowned. Although that does have its poetic attraction if I'm in the right mood. somehow something even more mysterious is being pointed to. So that's something of the nature of this spiritual quest. And I think it's a quest as well as a path. It's this sort of mythic quest towards ultimate value. And that ultimate value in Buddhism is not just something that's beyond and out there. It is, in a manner of speaking, but it's also what's also in here. It's our true nature. It's what's who we really are, you could say. Buddhism doesn't get hooked on literal notions of is the goal external to me or internal to me. It says both and neither. Because this whole notion of internal and external are concepts within this dualistic framework of space. And the enlightened mind knows no categories like that. So again, you've got this paradoxical way of talking in becoming one with reality. We actually become, if you like, who we really are. We become who we always were. And yet, in order to realize that, there's a path and a quest and transcendence to realize that. And the whole of the phenomenal universe is seen, not just even the phenomenal universe, the whole of reality itself is seen as unfolding, you could say, according to natural principles. It's seen as a dynamic unfolding process, or set of processes. Condition co-production, Pratitya-samuppada, is the teaching, is the law of this unfolding. That everything is unfolding according to prior conditions, according to laws that arise in the universe naturally, and those laws are governed by prior conditions. So this unfolding is what really is going on, this unfolding according to natural phenomena, according to natural laws, rather than some sort of static universe with an eternal me and an eternal God, or somehow a static universe with a finite me and no God. Either of those is not how Buddhism sees the truth. Buddhism sees this as a constant flux that we're part of. But somewhere in those natural laws, there is the law, or laws, or processes that lead to enlightenment, that lead to Bodhi. So Buddhism is about cooperating with reality so that we can realize Buddhahood, so that we can attain to Buddhahood. And it's really important that we see Buddhism as part of the natural way things are. It's not an imposition on reality. It's not, in that sense, a human construct. It's an unfolding, a set of methods that helps us grow into Buddhahood by using natural laws. So just as you've got laws of matter, like physics and biology, and well, physics and chemistry, and then you've got laws of life, like biology, and laws of mind, like psychology and those disciplines, you've got laws that help you move towards Buddhahood, if you want to. That's the other thing. Buddhism doesn't this natural unfolding that I'm talking about doesn't mean that everything is going to be all right and we're all eventually, if we wait long enough, become shining Buddhas and vessels of infinite wisdom and compassion just by waiting. It would be nice if it did, but it doesn't. So it's not this notion that we just, you know, we've entered some sort of spiritual age and we privileged ones are just going to ride this current of evolution all the way to Buddhahood. It's not saying that. What Buddhism is saying is that if you make an effort and you want to grow, then it is within human consciousness to do that. Human consciousness, self-consciousness, has the capacity to develop itself in a way that simple consciousness normally doesn't. We can choose to develop, we can choose to grow. And the principle, the way that we can choose to grow, is by utilizing, cooperating with the law of karma, which states that if we act in ever-increasing skillful ways, if our thoughts, our volitions are ever more selfless, if they're not tainted so much by selfishness, if they're not so much tainted by me, by egotism, by greed, by hatred, by ignorance, the more we can act from kindness, from generosity, from altruism, from concern for others, the more, according to the law of karma, our consciousness will develop. The more we'll grow. And it's not just develop in an arbitrary way. The law of karma says that your consciousness, all of our consciousnesses, even though we're unique in our psyches, the law says that you all develop, all of us, if you act skillfully, in ways that are common. And what happens is that our consciousness becomes clearer, brighter, more creative. There's a feeling of greater fulfillment, a greater sense of connectedness with each other, with life, with the world, the natural world around us. There's a greater sense of happiness. There's a greater sense of freedom. There's a greater, in that freedom and joy and fulfillment, there's less fear, because fear arises from clinging to me. So there's freedom from fear, ultimately freedom from all limitation whatsoever, if we allow the law of karma to unfold in our lives. If we cooperate with it in that skillful way. The law of karma, it's a double-edged thing, isn't it? Because the law of karma also works the other way. And the more we act from egotism, from craving, from hatred, from small-mindedness, from pettiness, from selfishness, the more consciousness closes down, the more narrow, the more brittle, the less fulfilled, the more alienated, the more split, the more disconnected it becomes. And you can see this at operation in ourselves and in others around us. You can see over time us creating our own lives, our own world, through our states of mind. Movingly, a friend of mine was talking just this morning about her mother who recently died and her father who's very, very ill. And she was saying in her the death of her mother and in the illness of her father, she can see how both of them have created their mind, created their world through their lives, through their actions. And that when you're faced with death, when, you know, your health is taken away from you, when you're about to lose everything that you hold dear, everything that you've built an identity around, a life around, when we are all faced with that, which we will be, all that matters is the state of consciousness that we've developed, the mind that we've developed, the volitions that we've developed. That's all that we have. And that's all that will transcend death. That's all that will transcend death. So, from that perspective, if you take this evolutionary perspective, this kind of evolutionary cosmic perspective that we can grow into ever more alive, conscious beings, and if you think that that's all that we're going to have, if you think about the fact that that's all that we're going to have when we die, and you think about the certainty of death, from that perspective, what I conclude is that the spiritual life is what life is. It's not an add-on, it's not an optional extra. The growth of consciousness towards ultimate truth and reality itself, towards our own potential, is what life is meant to be. Do you see what I mean? Is what we are. This yearning for fulfillment that we all feel is that yearning for growth. But often, very, very often, that yearning for fulfillment gets hooked onto, I don't know, in my case, you know, carrot cake or something as ridiculous as that. Food, sugar, sex, lovers, somebody that will love us unconditionally, possessions, career, fame, fortune. That yearning for fulfillment gets hooked onto lesser realities, lesser truths, lesser things. All of those things are finite, aren't they? They're finite and they're temporal. How can any of them, how can carrot cake, how can even that perfect, seemingly perfect lover ever fulfill the yearning for the infinite that each of us harbours in our human hearts? How can anything finite and temporal fulfill the infinite? Do you see what I mean? Nothing finite and temporal can do that. And yet, we so often spend our lives chasing those things. And in a certain sense, of course we do. I mean, it's not... what else are we going to kind of chase unless we know any better? Even when we do know better, I seemingly sometimes seem to know better, it's really difficult to go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, which can feel so abstract and intangible when the chocolate, the sex, the iPhone, everything that the world offers is so real and shiny and glittering. It can feel like we're abstract. You know, I'm talking about something unreal. And the real world is all this tangible stuff. But actually, all of us somewhere know, we wouldn't be here otherwise, that the so-called phenomenal world, which seems so real, doesn't do it. Certainly, that's not to knock all those other things, but I don't think that they are adequate as expressions of our life. So I think another sort of central teaching that Bhante seems to have is that you don't have to move away from worldly pleasures all in one go. In fact, you don't have to force yourself to renounce sex or carrot cake, fortunately. But what he does say is, look at what you're building your life around, look at what you're building your identity around. And if you're building your identity around those things, well, don't expect to be fulfilled. I mean, he doesn't say that, I'm saying, paraphrasing. Don't expect to be fulfilled by any of those things if you make a life around them. If your life is around making as much money as you can so that you can feel good about yourself, so that you can buy whatever you want, if that is the sole purpose of your life, the central thread in your life, you will end up unhappy. All of these things that I'm talking about are what Buddhism calls false refuges. We all go for refuge to something. Some of those things that we go for refuge don't lead to ultimate fulfillment. They're limited. They're really, really finite. They're limited. And I'm afraid that includes everything that our culture tends to say will lead to happiness. I'm afraid it includes even our partners, our children, our houses, our careers, our fame, our fortune, our bodies, whatever. All of those things are temporal and finite and not adequate to build a life around. So what Buddhism's saying is that you can have those things, but don't have them as the only thing that you're building your life around. Grow up out of them, beyond them. Keep transcending ourselves. And that's what going for refuge to the three jewels is about. It's saying, that sounds too weak. Put at the centre of your life, or as centrally as you can, this urge for real fulfilment. The Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, I know that they sound like constructs of a religion, but actually they're human values. They're values in reality. The Buddha is the ultimate fulfillment of human potential realized in human form. The Dharma is reality as it really is, this unfolding flux of conditioned arising. And the Sangha is testament to the fact that none of us is a separate, isolated individual, that none of us exists in a vacuum, that actually what is a truer reality, representation of reality, is connectedness that we have with each other. So they're not artificial values. They're pointing to the way things really are. And it's that we try and go for refuge to, that we try and commit to more and more fully. We use this law of karma to grow. At some point, there's other processes that come into play. The Dharma processes, the Dharma Niyama processes come into play. And those processes take us not just from a expansive, fulfilled consciousness to... they take us beyond even that. They take us to this self-transcendence that Rumi's talking about, this transcendence beyond me. They take us beyond this sense of me as a separate entity. They take us all the way to Buddhahood. So karma and dharma processes are the tools, the tools in reality, the process in reality that we're trying to orientate ourselves to. That always happens gradually. That happens gradually because you can't commit to those processes all in one go. I can't. I've never known anybody who could. We're not those sorts of beings. That commitment is always a gradual process. Even if you have a sudden flash of insight, that won't completely transform your life all in one go. Transformation is always gradual. So going for refuge to the three jewels is a path of ever deepening commitment, ever deepening realization of what is of real value in our lives. And Bhante has seen the whole of the spiritual path in terms of deepening going for refuge. Deepening going for refuge. He identifies levels of going for refuge. These levels are, they're like signposts along the way. Actually, there's just a continuum of deepening going for refuge, of deepening realization, of deepening transformation, of deepening self-transcendence. But he identifies various levels which are like markers along the way. He identifies five of them. So first of all, he says that somebody can be going for refuge at a cultural level, which isn't really going for refuge at all. It's where, it doesn't happen so much in this country, but where somebody is born into a Buddhist family, and they think of themselves as Buddhist simply because their family is Buddhist or their culture is Buddhist, but they're not aware of actually trying to practice. That would be cultural going for refuge, which really isn't going for refuge. It's just people say, yes, I'm a Buddhist. The next level is, in a way, the first level of going for refuge. And what this level is where somebody is sincerely, they've sincerely seen something of the three jewels, and they want to orientate their life towards it. They want to move towards this, these values of the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha. What's more, they don't just want to do it, they are orientating themselves towards it. It's not that they're always able to manifest that fully in their lives, because the commitment isn't necessarily central to them. But there is this sincere aspiration to practice, for example, practice the five precepts, the ethical precepts, this sincere aspiration to grow through meditation, through Dharma study, this sincere aspiration to connect with others on the basis of spiritual values, to form Sangha, to become part of a Sangha. And that level of refuge, going for refuge, if somebody does that within Tri Ratna, and they want to, we recognise that by becoming a Mitra. That's what Lina's going to be doing tonight. She's saying, yes, she is a Buddhist. She is a Buddhist. She aspires to become more and more of a Buddhist by going for refuge more and more deeply. And she's living that out in her life already through practice, through meditation, through ethical life, through deepening her sense of connection in Sangha. That's what she's saying. That's what a Mitra is saying. They're saying, yes, I am going for refuge to the three jewels. Bhante calls this the provisional stage of going for refuge. He says it's provisional because it can't be guaranteed to always last. It depends on how the conditions are that you find yourself in. But on the other hand, provisional doesn't mean that it's not genuine. It's sincere. It's sincere. And part of the challenge of this level is, can you keep remembering that you've got to find conditions that work for you? Like, can you keep remembering to go on retreat? Can you keep remembering to stay in contact with people? And particularly that's going to be important for Lina, because Lina is going to move very, very, very soon to Minneapolis, to join her husband in Minneapolis, where there is no Tri Ratna Sangha. So it's particularly poignant that Nina's becoming a Mitra here tonight, and then she will be our Mitra in Minneapolis, the Tri Ratna's Mitra in Minneapolis. So that puts on her shoulders quite a weighty responsibility. First of all, to keep practicing herself, to stay connected with Sangha, albeit at a distance. Unfortunately, technology allows you to do that. But to keep in contact with our own aspiration, keep contact with others who are also aspiring, to keep practicing even when she hasn't got a Tri Ratna Buddhist centre to go to. Fortunately, there are other Buddhists of other schools in Minneapolis that she can practice with. And to keep, in a way, the flag of Buddhism alive for others that she might come into contact with. So that's a weighty thing that Lena's going to be saying that she wants to do. It's easy, in a way, to practice when you're around the LBC. You just turn up. I ring bells, or somebody rings bells, and even if you can't count to 10, you're sort of doing something. It's better than not. Lena's going to have a much tougher time with things. But she's a courageous, very, very resourceful, intelligent, emotionally very, very positive woman who I think if anybody can do it, Lena can do it in Minneapolis. And she's invited me and others to go to Minneapolis to lead retreats, and sounds quite good to me. So Lena is going to be, yes, saying that she's going for refuge in this sense tonight. That's what's going to happen tonight. I just think it's fantastic, really, really tremendous. Every time somebody does that, they are not just moving towards growth themselves, but they become like a flame in darkness. They become this light for others in a world that really, really needs these flames. So I think that's just fantastic, really, really fantastic. That isn't the end of the path. For those that want to, you can deepen your commitment further. You can deepen your commitment further. There's no end to this deepening, as you might have gathered, because the whole of the spiritual path is encompassed in this commitment. But you can deepen your commitment further to make going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha the central thing in your life, the central commitment around which everything else clusters. You can do that in Tri Ratna, particularly in Tri Ratna, that's manifests when somebody's ordained. And in Tri Ratna you can ask for ordination if you want to move towards that level of commitment, effective going for refuge, where you're going to take public vows that say, yes, this is the most important thing in my life. This is what I build my life around. I may still be married or have a partner. I may still have a family. I may still have a job, and I may still have carrot cake. But none of those things are going to be central. They're not going to be what I build my life around. They're somehow in relation to something far more central to me, which is going for refuge to the Three Jewels. The whole ordination process is like a quest within this larger quest, where you are challenged, supported, encouraged, trained, befriended to make this going for refuge that you have, as it were, more and more effective, till it's recognised as being something that you can commit to. And then you're given a new name, you're welcomed into the Order Sangha. Spiritually, you're said to be reborn. But that isn't the end. How could it be? Because order members are unfortunately not Buddhas. I don't know of any order member that is a Buddha, including Bhante Sangharakshita, who is, I think, well, he's the most spiritually vital, impressive man that I have ever met and am ever likely to meet. He's still not a Buddha. This quest is infinite. So if you're one of these goal-oriented people that is quite impatient and wants instant gratification, you press a button and you add to basket and it's yours within a day. If that's the sort of attitude that you have, well, you know, it's not going to work. It's not going to work on this spiritual quest. The path is infinite. Nevertheless, there arises a point, it's said, where you can't ever fall back from this goal of enlightenment, because at that point you're going for refuge is penetrated by a vision of reality that has changed you at the very, very core of your being, changed you sort of irrevocably and irreversibly, so that you can never, never pretend again or fall asleep again. You can never lose sight of the ultimate meaning of your life. You may not have been completely transformed, in fact you won't have done, but from that point on you can't fall back. Even if you wanted to, something in you won't let you fall asleep again. And that is what Bhante calls real going for refuge, because you've seen reality as it really is, at least enough so that you can't ever forget it. You've had a glimpse of a reality that unfolds beyond self-clinging, beyond egotism. Even that's not enlightenment. Enlightenment is something else. He calls it absolute going for refuge. It is this drop merging into the ocean, this ocean being swallowed into the drop. Absolute going for refuge. Who knows what that means? We can only sort of point to it. We can only imagine it in beautiful forms. But the whole of the path from where we are now to enlightenment itself can be termed in terms of ever-increasing commitment to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, ever-increasing deepening going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And of course that then plays out in you know, we've been talking about integration and positive emotion, all the stages of the path, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity. It plays out in our lives by increasing all of those, by moving along the path of integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. But it can be principally understood in terms of deepening commitment. Deepening commitment. That's the central understanding that Bhante has had. You know, so when people say, oh, you've become a Buddhist, does that mean that you can't do X or Y or Z? What they're not understanding, they're thinking in terms of rules and sort of rules and regulations, some of which might be helpful, but they're not thinking in principial terms of what a Buddhist really is. And unfortunately, elsewhere in the Buddhist world, Buddhists themselves have got into thinking in those terms. So Bhante Sangharakshita was a monk, a Theravadan bhikkhu, a monk for I think about 17 years in India. And the monastic life is governed by several hundred rules that govern how you have to dress, how you eat, how you sleep, how you walk, how you greet people, what you can touch, what you can't touch. Everything is governed by a minutiae of rules. And Bhante lived like that for nearly two decades, lived according to those rules, gradually saw that those rules in themselves were not it. Yeah? In themselves, they're not the spiritual life. How could they be? And unfolded for himself this deeper understanding of what the spiritual life really is. I want to conclude, though, by talking about something else, in a way. I've outlined, or tried to outline, I've not done it very clearly, perhaps, not clearly enough. You can read more about it, if you want to, in Subhuti's paper called Initiation into a New Life, which is available online on thebuddhistcenter.com, for example. I want to talk about it in another way, which is not just in terms of ever-deepening commitment, but in terms of ever-deepening love. The spiritual life in terms of falling in love with the ideal. Commitment still can feel like an act of will that's rather partial. I can sort of commit with my head sometimes, and if I force myself, I can force myself to do all sorts of things. But actually, the spiritual life, that's not enough. We do need our heads and our energy and our will, but we also need to fall in love. We need to fall in love. We need to yearn we need to desire above all other things this fulfillment, this freedom, this transcendence, this reality that arises, that we can touch and taste and experience when we let go of me, of self-clinging. We need to fall in love with that, just as you would, or as we would with a lover. Just as we would with all our hearts yearn for that perfect, perfect other person that's going to fulfill all our desires. We need to fall in love with reality itself. We need to fall in love with the Buddha. We need to fall in love with any archetypal manifestation that the Buddha takes, that reality takes. This is how, at least in part, we'll experience going for refuge. We'll experience it as an opening of the heart, a falling in love. I guess different people experience it in different ways. I'm particularly drawn to this yearning for fulfillment through love. The Sufi tradition there's a strand in the Sufi tradition. I'm reading a treatise by a man called Ahmad Ghazali, a 12th century Sufi, and it's a metaphysical treatise on love and how love is the whole of the path. The whole of the path. But interestingly, you have to fall in love with reality itself. You can't short-circuit the love in any other way. If you fall in love with anything less than a completely self-transcendent reality, then you've lost your way. So, for example, he outlines that you fall in love, that love, this path of love, has three, he calls them swords, three swords that cut you off from lesser loves. So in the Sufi tradition, you talk of the beloved. The beloved is, in a way, this transcendent reality in form. At least that's how I've understood it. I guess in the Islamic tradition, that would be the Prophet. You fall in love with the beloved. In the Sufi tradition, the beloved can manifest as a beautiful person that you're attracted to. But it's a beautiful person that embodies reality itself, a muse that won't let you consummate your desire, but draws you ever further on in this unfulfilled yearning, this longing. And the first sword is called, in Ahmed Ghazali's treatise, it's the sword of the beloved's jealousy. And this sword cuts you off from yearning anything other than the beloved. So you're willing to forego fame, fortune, pleasure, any other fulfillment. You're willing to let go of just for the beloved. All you desire is to gaze upon the beloved's face and to be united with the beloved. That's all you desire. So that's the first step that you Ahmed Ghazali outlines. And then the second step, the second sword that he outlines, is that you have to renounce your egotism. It's no good just yearning for the beloved if you're still in love with yourself. So you have to forego love for self. There just has to be the beloved. There just has to be every moment of your waking existence and your even your unconscious existence has to be directed towards yearning for this beloved. And even that's not enough. Because in this model of the lover and the beloved, you've still got a duality. And love itself transcends all duality. And so the final sword is cutting you off from even yearning for the beloved. So you've stopped yearning now for the beloved. You have no sense of yourself. You've died to your own egotism. And all there is love, without any sense of separation, without any sense of self or other. What a beautiful vision of the path, just in terms of purer and purer notions of love. That's what he's pointing to. And I think that's what the spiritual life can feel like. It can feel like a greater and greater ecstasy and bliss and fulfillment and joy in something that keeps pulling us along, keeps sort of moving us along. It's just fantastic. It's just fantastic. I could go on talking about this, but I'm going to have to stop in a moment. But think in terms of ever-increasing love. What is it that your heart really, really yearns for? Listen to that. And then see if you can find that fulfillment, not just in those external baubles that, you know, are hung before us by our cultural surroundings, but see if you can find it in your imaginal life, in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. See if you can find it in reality itself. And if you move towards that, even if we never become Buddhas, we will have lived a life that is worth living. And when we come to die, we won't have regrets. We won't have regrets. And that feels the most important thing that we can do, I think, with our lives. So that's what Bhante means by going for refuge to the three jewels.